Monday, September 1st, Labor Day. A holiday throughout our own nation, but the start of another week of war in Europe. Now here are reports direct from two of the warring nations, Britain and Germany, supplemented by bulletins from our newsroom in New York. First, overseas to Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lonis in Berlin. 2 years ago today, Hitler's armies had fought their way well into Poland, and World War Number Two was underway. Since that time, this country has been in a continuous state of war, and there's no indication here that there'll be any let-up for some time to come. The face of Europe has changed. One country after another went down before the smashing, seemingly irresistible power of the German Wehrmacht as it slashed across the continent. Now the same military force, which has been called the greatest in the world, is in a battle to the death with what the Germans themselves say is the toughest enemy they have yet encountered, Soviet Russia. And it's in the East where the interest of most Germans is focused. There's not the slightest doubt that the Russians have stolen the show from the British as far as the average German is concerned. His interest is there, because that's where his sons, his brothers, perhaps his father, and certainly many of his friends are fighting. Every day, the German war bulletins tell about the fanatical resistance of the Red Soldiers, their counterattacks, and their do-or-die spirit. They also tell about thousands and thousands of captured Soviets. The total now is well over the million mark, the destruction of unheard-of amounts of material, and the fearful loss of lives, which the Germans now estimate at several millions. To the average German, that means only one thing. His own people must be spilling some blood, too. Of course, the Germans have published no casualty lists, nor have they given any hint as to what their losses in round figures might be. But stories from the front, death notices in the German newspapers, and just plain common sense tells us that this campaign in the East is the most costly the Germans have embarked upon in the past 2 years. So it's natural that the Germans, although confident of victory, are wondering what the third year of the war will bring for them. Meanwhile, England still stands in much the same position as it was when war began. Last night, the British dropped bombs in western and southwestern Germany. But the reports here say that the damage was insignificant. German night fighters get credit for shooting down 8 of the attacking planes. Enemy bombers paid a visit to Berlin early last night. This morning's press states that the planes were British. But a later report carried by the German radio said that the planes flew in from the Baltic Sea. The Germans report that the attackers were turned back before they reached the city proper. Strong formations of German bombers carried out what appears, from first reports, to be a heavy raid on Hull. German pilots tell of widespread fires and say that extensive damage was done in the southwest and eastern part of the city and east of the Victoria Docks. Other German squadrons are sent over to bomb 4 British airfields in the area of Lincolnshire. It's reported here that 2 of the British machines sent up to intercept the Germans were shot down. German figures on British daylight air losses for the month of August were released today. They put the Royal Air Force losses for the month at 260 planes, which works out at roughly 8.5 planes per day. 216 of these machines were fighters, and the other 44 are said to have been bombers, which attempted to attack points on the Channel coast. In the Mediterranean basin, the Germans report that Alexandria and Port Said were bombed during the night, but no details have been released so far. Turning back to the east, a late report here today states that a strong force of Russians in the Novgorod area are in an especially difficult position. The report indicates that a new pocket has been formed in that district and that the situation is serious for the Russians. Another message tells how 2 Red Divisions were encircled and destroyed east of Salla by French and German troops. The Germans also report that they're squeezing the semicircle around Leningrad, which is said to be surrounded on 3 sides. As the picture looks today, Leningrad is still in Russian hands. The Germans are still about as far from Moscow as they were 2 weeks ago. Kiev is holding up, although the Germans report they are on 3 sides of the city. And in the deep south, Odessa, although ringed by Allied troops, is withstanding the siege. And so the war swings into its third year. From my observations, it appears that the average German looks upon the beginning of the third year as just another day. Newspapers today showed no particular anniversary enthusiasm and are inclined to give more space to other matters. On the Wilhelmstrasse, officials pointed out that September 1st meant only the beginning of the police action in Poland. In their viewpoint, World War Number 2 didn't start until September 3rd. This is Charles Lonius in Berlin. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And now here are some late bulletins received here in the NBC newsroom. From Moscow comes word that Russia's Central Army is still counterattacking strongly, trying to smash back the German drive toward Moscow. And other Soviet forces are said to be holding out doggedly on the Leningrad and southern fronts. Russian dispatches say that the Germans were driven out of an unidentified town in the Ukraine with heavy losses, and 1,200 Germans were killed in an attempt to take a far northern city. Soviet spokesmen tell of fierce hand-to-hand fighting with volunteers joining in street fighting to repel the invaders. The Russians also say they've smashed a German attempt to bridge the Great Dnieper River. The four-man crew of a Russian bomber is credited with demolishing a pontoon bridge on which the Germans had worked for 4 days. Anti-aircraft fire hit the bomber and set it afire, and then, say the Russians, the Soviet flyers headed their flaming aircraft for the bridge, exploding their bomb load on the pontoons and wrecking the entire project. It was suicide assignment, for the Russian bomber crew was killed. Now we take you to London.
This is John McVane in London. Germany seems to have prodded from both sides last night. British bombers went over and attacked Cologne and Essen and other industrial targets in the Ruhr and Rhineland, while a German report reaching here speaks of Russian bombers also entering Germany. The British bombers had to overcome bad weather and persistent clouds. The docks at Boulogne were bombed and mines were laid in enemy waters. 7 British bombers are missing and 1 fighter didn't come back from a night patrol over German-occupied France. More German planes than usual came over Britain last night to make a sharp attack on Hull. 1 German plane was shot down. British Army headquarters today reported that British and Russian troops have established contact in Iran. It said the meeting was at Sana, 70 miles north of Kermanshah. The British say they met a small detachment of the forward Soviet forces who withdrew to their headquarters after what is called a mutual exchange of compliments. The British Trade Unions Congress opened its annual general meeting in Edinburgh, Scotland today. You may know that the British trade unions have always been strongly anti-communist. But now, in the heat of battle, the working men of Britain intend to stretch out a friendly hand to the working men of Russia, who are fighting to protect their country from the Germans. The British trade unionists will be asked, probably tomorrow, to support a plan to send a delegation of union leaders to Moscow to work out with their Soviet opposite numbers establishment of a joint workers' council to carry on the fight against the Nazis. It's expected that Sir Walter Citrine will head the British Union men, and the group will probably fly to Moscow in the near future. According to all present predictions, the Union delegates will give the scheme overwhelming support. The meeting in Moscow, it's expected, will be the first of a series of meetings to be held alternately in Moscow and London between representatives of the Trades Union Congress and the Central Council of the Soviet Union. This morning, Mr. George Gibson, president of the Congress, urged that workers be told the reasons for holdups in production. Elementary common sense, he said, suggests that when men and women are compelled to stand idle by their machines, they should be told of the difficulties, whatever they may be. Mr. Gibson said the lag in production had been due to the wide dispersal of factories, the immense call-up of skilled men for the forces, the spreading of the remaining skilled men, and the spreading of the comparatively small amount of skilled management. Failure to deliver raw materials and to synchronize production and delivery of parts, the trade union chief said, was also partly to blame for the delays and confusion. Then Mr. Gibson told his union audience that at a recent luncheon he'd sat next to a British statesman. Mr. Gibson didn't give the statesman's name. He only said that he broadcasts on important occasions, that he refers to the Germans as Nazis, and that he seldom evinces conspicuous affection for Mussolini. Mr. Gibson quoted this anonymous statesman as declaring, "Gibson, we'll beat the blighters even if we have to live on porridge." For many years, the super correctness has been about the only adjective you could use to describe the dress of members of the various British ministries. From ministers and ambassadors down to almost the humblest clerk, British government services have been among the few places on earth that have successfully fought off the invasion of things like soft collars, colored shirts, and other 20th century changes in masculine dress. Until recently, you'd no more expect to see a man in a light suit behind the ministry desk than you'd expect to see there a man in a bathing suit. But when wartime changes come, they come quickly. The other day, I walked into one ministry to see a friend. I found him at his desk, no longer dressed in his usual well-tailored dark suit, but in what looked like gray battle dress. My friend explained that he was, in fact, wearing gray overalls, cut along the lines of British Army battle dress. My clothes were running short, and I had only a few clothes coupons to spare for a suit, he said. I went to my tailor and said I didn't have the 26 coupons necessary to buy a suit and asked him what he could do about it. We put our heads together and he made me this. Only 6 coupons. Now I wear it all the time to work. If it isn't worn out when the war's over, I'll use it for a skiing suit. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the latest news on the war. For word of developments at home, we turn now to Earl Godwin speaking from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. Washington awaits the dramatic arrival of 2 great Russian seaplanes which landed without previous notice at Nome, Alaska. With 47 persons traveling in those seaplanes with diplomatic passports. A sudden surprise to Washington, and no doubt about that, because the talk here had been on just who would comprise a 6-man government mission from here to Moscow to take up with the Russian government the business of what to send from the United States to Russia and how to pay for it, for the conduct of their war with Nazi Germany. And incidentally, there's no more news on the Russian flight to Alaska or the jump to Washington. Washington simply awaits a mysterious and exciting event. Today at 1:45 daylight time, President Roosevelt expects to deliver a brief radio address, which will be the American climax to an hour of radio talk on labor's great American holiday. But of course, this holiday happens to be the 2nd anniversary of Germany's invasion of Poland, the start of the war, the assault which started the World War, in which now 4/5 of the world's people live in countries, 26 countries, at war or affected by the aggressors of the Axis. The president could well be expected to call for a tremendously increased effort on the part of American labor, and probably will, and in addition to that, increased effort on the part of the whole population. But he gave a hint here last Friday that he might have something to say of international import. And whenever he says that, there's always whispering and rumors in Washington. Right now, the officials of the State Department are at close grips with one of the hardest and most important problems we have ever had in Washington. That is the problem of the Far East. And there's every possibility that there will be more and more of an effort on both sides of the Pacific to bring about friendly anti-war relations between this country and Japan. But it takes more than a mere signature to a paper for that. The whole subject of Japan and China, the whole subject of Japanese aims, and the whole subject of Japanese attitudes toward this country and everything else, and vice versa, the American position with respect to world events is something that the Japanese cannot understand any more than America cannot understand the Japanese position and attitude toward Asia. 2 vast populations with diplomatic opposite views on many subjects and diametrically opposed views on many subjects have been doing business for years and profitably and with friendly relations. Suddenly the business stops and there's actually a danger of devastating and ruinous war between the 2 countries. Actually, may I say to you, there is more danger than anyone realizes. Washington, as your national capital, as an entity, believes there is much more danger of trouble in the Pacific than there is across the Atlantic. Incidentally, neither side wants war. There the conversations start. And oddly enough, as the conversations start, the Japanese war against China starts with a greater Russian destruction. And from this country comes another severe anti-Japanese move. The president signed an okay yesterday on gas, oil, and lubricants to the Philippine Army. This action nullifies a 37-year-old act of Congress which required oil and all that stuff to be sent in American ships. And that's all from Washington at this time.
And that's the news from our own capital. Also heard during this morning's news roundup were direct reports from London and Berlin and bulletins from New York. Keep tuned to this station for the latest news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.